home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Ooh, good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Garrett is off tonight, but I hope he's having fun, and we have a great show lined up for you, a profound show around a huge, huge talent, not only in the LGBT community, but in the world, and particularly from the New York scene. This is artist Eric Rhine is going to be with us tonight. He is noted for his art and particularly how it affects or it has a profound comment on AIDS. And he also represents this huge legacy of LGBT history. And we will get into that further. Joining me in kind of a co-host role tonight is Crackpot. Crackpot sounds bad. I thought that was supposed to be a compliment. Noted, renowned journalist Brody Levesque, who has done the LGBTQ beat thoroughly. He was a senior editor for LGBTQ Nation. He is renowned across the journalism field. And so I'm very pleased to call him not only my friend, but tonight my co-host. Brody, welcome to the show. Yeah.
Good evening, Rob. How are you?
I am doing good. Thanks. How are you doing?
You're doing good. I'm fine. I think most of us here in my world of journalism are still reeling from today's announcement on the Paris Accord that the president has so kindly removed your country from. And I think it's just that coupled with everything else in the political field. It's going to be very nice to talk to Eric and to get a break from politics.
I know. No kidding. Although I've got to say, reeling has probably become an old habit for the journalism field at this point.
Yeah, it unfortunately, sadly, is. I think in a larger context, for my profession at any rate, it's become pretty difficult. We're under siege from a hostile administration, and conversely, we're also under siege from the supporters in the base of that hostile administration, and we're reporting on stories that most of us, quite frankly, never envisioned ever having to report on in the first place. So,
and we're not done.
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah. So, yeah, stay tuned. There's a lot. Brody, give us a little background before we bring him on of your relationship with Eric, how you came across his story and his work.
Eric is an amazing person, and he has an amazing story, and it actually starts because Eric would be considered legacy. His uncle was one of the literal founding members of a group of gay pioneers in the early 1960s who really were responsible for the commencement of what later morphed into the much larger LGBTQ movement. His uncle was Lige Clark, and Lige's partner was a gentleman by the name of Jack Nichols. Jack Nichols and Dr. Franklin Camney, who was one of the early pioneers and fought hard for LGBT equality rights, lived and worked in Washington, D.C., and they were responsible for the formation of the Mattachine Society. They were responsible for some of the early protests. And actually, Eric's uncle, Lige, was directly responsible for one of the more famous of the protests in front of the White House, one of the very first protests that Frank and Lige and Jack and Barbara Gittings and Kay Tobin Leyhausen and Paul Kunstler and some of the other early pioneers, it was just groundbreaking because in those days you could be arrested just even for being homosexual. But Lige and Jack also were responsible. They later moved to New York, and interestingly enough, they were probably the very first true national gay journalists. Elijah was an outstanding poet and yoga master and an author and a writer. Jack was a very, very good writer. And they had gotten together with, of all people, a porn producer by the name of Al Goldstein, who was starting up a new magazine in 1967 called Screw. And Jack and Lige had met Al at a party of a mutual friend, Dr. George Weinberg, who sadly just recently here passed away. George was responsible for coining the phrase homophobic. It was actually George that came up with that. And they were at a party one night, and George introduced them to Al. And Lige actually was the one that took the initiative. He and Jack had been kicking around the idea of some sort of publication. And, of course, back in those days, the publications were basically mimeographed handouts and things like that.
Right.
But they had been writing in a handout that had been done by the Mattachine Society that was known as the Homosexual Citizen. And both Lige and Jack had been writing for this, and they convinced Al to start it within Screw Magazine. So Screw Magazine, which was essentially for straight people, and it was porn. There's no other polite way of putting it. But there was a whole section in there that Jack and Lige put out called Gay Today, and Gay Weekly, or Gay. And then later, Lige and Jack talked Al into making a standalone publication. And it was amazing. Unfortunately, fast-forwarding to 1975, under circumstances that were still a little bit murky, although we've gotten some answers, Eric's Uncle Lige was murdered in Mexico while on a trip with a gentleman that we later found out actually was a contract officer for the Central Intelligence Agency. And there was some murky things going on. And unfortunately, Lige was killed in Mexico. He wasn't the target of the people that were doing the shooting. The gentleman he was with was the actual target. And as the military say, Lige, unfortunately, was collateral damage. And that kind of broke Jack. And then Jack retreated from the scene for a while. And then Jack later came out and published an online version of Gay, known as Gay Today. And again, that was sponsored by another porn producer, Bad Puppy Productions. Then, unfortunately, Jack got very, very sick and got cancer, and he passed away in 2005. Now, what's interesting about this story was, while I was doing research for a screenplay and a book on Lige, I was given Eric's telephone number. So I did some research on Eric, and I'm like, because it's, you know, this Eric is the nephew, and his mom was Lige's sister, Shelby.
Right.
And so I called Eric, and I left a message, and as it turns out, Eric and his mom were actually at I guess you would call it a gallery showing. I'm not sure if that's appropriate, and Eric, when we bring him on, can correct me. But some of his work was being exhibited and sponsored by the U.S. Embassy in Austria. And so Shelby and Eric were over there. And then he returned my call, and we started going back and forth. And I did more research on him. It was just fascinating. And then I realized that in his own right, Eric was a rather significant contributing member of the arts community. And then, of course, even more so to the point that he was also very much an HIV and AIDS activist, and he was the type of person that, you know, for a journalist, it's like, oh, goody, we have more stories here. So it's kind of 6 degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon, but in this case, it was 6 degrees of separation from, say, you know, Lige Clark and Jack Pickles and Frank Camney and the early gay pioneers. But he's got a very compelling story. I find him a very fascinating person. I love talking to him. And it's just one of those things where I think it's kind of cool that today marks the beginning of Pride. This is Pride Month 2017. And here we are honoring Eric, who's been a moving force in the New York arts community for HIV and AIDS activism. He's legacy of literally one of the founders of the gay movement itself, Lige Clark. So, I think it's kind of timely that we're kind of kicking off Pride, happy Pride, by the way, with this show on Eric.
Great. And let's bring Eric on and let him do some speaking for himself. Eric, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really thrilled was touched that Brody reached out and connected us, and it's been meaningful to get to know him. And in a way, I actually feel like my uncle Elijah has kind of guided me and Brody together, so he can help support me actually in telling the story.
Eric, how much is your uncle's spirit in terms of an inspiration for your work?
Tremendously. First, I feel like I have a real sense of my uncle Elijah is very much with me, even though he was killed when I was a teenager. And there are things I could say that reinforce that year continuously, that he gives me signs of that. I moved to New York in 1980, and it happened to be seven blocks from where my uncle and Jack lived on East 7th Street. And my experience of being part of the East Village art scene, and which was in turn really devastated by the AIDS epidemic, seems for me, in my experience of how I experienced the world, rather divinely guided that I would be placed in that vicinity of the world to continue through my generation's experience, particularly with AIDS, the evolution of gay rights and visibility, and there are signs continuously from my uncle that he's there participating.
Yeah, absolutely. When you came out and you had this huge icon as your uncle, did that help your coming out process, or did you still have a struggle, dealing with who you actually were?
Well, I don't really cite any particular time of coming out. It's more that I just emerged, I guess, in part, because I have really quite special parents, and my upbringing at large is rather expansive and inclusive. My father taught art education when I was a boy, and my mother was very much involved with the university life as well, both as a not so much as a university wife. She was quite independent and a free spirit, but my sister and I, Jamie, spent a lot of our time in my father's art studio at the university, very much included in the adults' lives and as their children's were, so there was not any kind of separation. And it was, the 60s. I was born in 1961, so we were particularly joined by my mother to go to protests for the Vietnam War, and there was on the college campus, the art department, I remember, one day there was a body painting, out on the mall. And, influenced by our first trip to New York City with visiting my uncle and Jack, when we would, follow the Hare Krishnas down the street dancing, I would play Hare Krishna on the college campus in South Carolina where we were at the time. And with my dog, Daisy, running after me. Swimming in the fountains outside the college building.
Wonderful. What drew you to art as your means of expression?
Well, I think my parents would say I was born, being an artist and making art, but then certainly the influence of being around my father and his colleagues and just being engaged in art just guided me and helped supported that throughout. I feel really blessed because that experience, the way my father experienced making art and taught and influenced us, it was as if really through art making you're connected with a greater a great source that is well, like he to say God, like a God source is more religious interpretation than I feel of it. And to say that it's beyond, you know, another source is not really what I feel either. I feel it's a part of us, but also comes through us, and then the information that comes, even sort of psychically, is translated into an object that happens to be, you know, called a work of art. But really, it's the experience of life, which is the art. So through childhood and adulthood, and you know, in my teen years going into adulthood, my creativity has always served me well as a way of processing whatever experiences I would be having and helping to make sense of it afterwards in some way.
Let me ask you this, because you and I have had conversations over this last summer, and your mom and I, of course, talked about this too, but how much of an influence, and Rob, you should know this, one of the things that his Uncle Lige actually said to his mom, Shelby, was don't be surprised if Eric turns out to be gay. That was actually, Lige actually told his sister that, but one of the things that I got from the conversations I had with you and your mom over the summer, and I know this is a terribly important part of your background, but explain to Rob and me why the connections to those Kentucky mountain hills is so terribly important to not only, you know, your upbringing, but your mom's and your Uncle Wash as well, because that you've even told me it factored very much into your sense of spirituality, your consciousness, and looking at how you interpret it into your art. Would you mind talking about that real quick?
No, well, in fact, when you were giving your introduction and talked about you know, what happened today with Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement, it struck me when the news came that there was deregulation going to happen and allowing basically, you know, waste from the coal mines to go back down into the streams, my mother called him. and I feel like I'm starting to tear up and give a wave of emotion myself, but she, you know, cried most of the day because of the waste of the coal mine being able to go back down into the streams of Kentucky. And so, when you within that, you know, I don't have any differentiation or separation between what is happening to our bodies and, you know, with me, you know, the challenge of HIV and the environment and other global issues. There's not a lot left of what my mother experienced and my uncle experienced in Hindman, Kentucky, except for, you know, the grace of a Appalachian Arts Center. And also across the street from that, there's a music shop, which is dedicated to maintaining the legacy of the Hindman Dulcimer. Most of the town itself has been really destroyed by kind of a lack of imagination and some, you know, greed of more limited thinkers. There's also the Settlement School, which is dedicated to continuing some of the mountain traditions alive. But when we go down there, for instance, to the Dulcimer Festival once a year, it really opens up our hearts and feeds our spirit. There's a little family cemetery where my uncle is buried, and also cousin Jimmy, who actually died through the AIDS epidemic, and we go and tend to. And my mother particularly likes going there when, as she says, the red buds are blooming and coming out in the spring in the dogwood. But she actually was just there. There's also a mountain, you know, storytelling tradition and the mountain ballads, but I think also feed into my work as an artist and how I am drawn to telling stories within my work, and particularly within the Leaves piece that I have, which is my ongoing AIDS memorial piece to pay tribute and honor those I've known personally who died.
Okay, Rob?
Can you talk a little bit more about how, I mean, the AIDS epidemic obviously was a huge foundation of of your work and the statement that you're making through your work. How did that start first coming out through you?
I think that my part of my influence going back to my uncle Lige was finding books that he had written with Jack when I was just on the threshold of puberty. My mother had these books, I Have More Fun With You Than Anybody, which they wrote in 1972, and it deals with their relationship and their activism, but also very much about their philosophies of life, particularly my being brought into my uncle, who was very much of a humanist and an expansive thinker. And there's a real core sense of a broad sense of spirituality within the things that they had in the books as well, on how to be an expansive, not only a liberated gay person, but an expansive human being. So if I look back, I feel that my own process of the news of finding out that I was positive and then going forward was really one of seeing how I could use that information to live as expansively as possible. And I delved into some metaphysical philosophies and with very much with the support of support groups. Like in New York, there was one called the Healing Circle, which gathered around initially the work of Louise Hay and then also teachers like Ram Dass, who actually really remembered or was pointed out to me recently was a friend of Uncle Lige and Jack. So I had a journey through my news and my status of looking into the connections of my mind and body and spirit and seeing what healing could come of that, if not physically, being that I wouldn't die from it, even emotionally, and then have some depth of understanding of what this could offer me.
No, I relate to that a lot because I actually was in Louise Hay's living room in the 80s when it was 40 men in her living room starting that whole process, when it all came out. And I took a friend of mine who came down with AIDS in 1985 to her, to her group. And it grew out of her living room and into a community center. And then she went to New York and, doing, around the country, and it became, a very big aspect of the experience. How did you,
I experienced a larger workshop with Louise myself, that this group, the Healing Circle, went to. Yeah, she actually, Louise Hay and Marion Williamson and this woman named Sally Fisher, who had this program called the AIDS Mastery, all came together to the Healing Circle. And I remember one of the experiences that transformed from them being there is this room of about 250 people lifted Louise Hay and Marion Williamson and Sally Fisher above their heads and moved them, over around the room, as if they were floating.
I
appreciate you sharing your own experience when you first connected, and now that you're sharing actually that you had experienced similar types of work with Louise Hay is quite meaningful.
Yeah, it was with both, because I was also, for whatever reason, I ended up in the living rooms of Louise Hay and Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson was doing lectures in West Hollywood, and she would have prayer circles in her living room, and that's how they started. And I mean, I literally was sitting next to her, holding her hand as she did different prayers. And the energy of both of them, and it was a time when the community was filled with hopelessness, and these spiritual people came out And to your point, it wasn't necessarily like everybody was healed physically and many were not, but it created an undercurrent of a spiritual awareness that I think was necessary. Where do you, that spiritual bubbling up, what, how does that come out through your work and your art?
It came out quite naturally while I was experiencing the grooves. Right before I touched the positive, I was involved with doing a wearable, one-of-a-kind construction that I was showing through gallery and artists and places, and it actually dovetailed into the fashion world too. But they were very elaborate little objects that were cuffs and brooches, and then they were translating into breastplates and things of armor. They're constructed from wire armatures with fabric stretched over them from different parts of the world, everything from European brocades to Japanese kimono fabrics, and then embellished with bits of found objects and jewelry, indicating some ornamentation. So they were very kind of related to armor, but also to second skins or crystals from insects. And for me, making them before I tested positive, I more, in the recent years, began to think of them as premonitions or things that were to come. And when with the news of my status, I let go of the wearable things and really translated them into armature and these kind of cage-like structures that seemed like they would emerge from my body, because very much probably also influenced by me experiencing a lot of acupuncture and massage and body work. I was in tune with the inner workings of my body more. So one of the first pieces that I made, which I call a phallic self-portrait, is focus of it around my erection, that has indications of an abdomen and also going down to the thighs and the legs into more like a root system. And they're embellished with little pieces of jewelry, like things that would be passed from one lover to another. The casing of a ring is on the head of my penis, where the slit is, would be. And then there's a, where the anal opening is, there's a casement of a brooch. And then a washer is indicating like maybe the navel or where the energy center would be. And another ornamentation is where the sternum is. So they have it, and they're tied very delicately with nylon thread that looks kind of like hair. So they're very corporal. And in keeping with, like, not necessarily being conscious of what I'm making, but something, information coming through me, in retrospect, they seem to address this tension at the time of celebrating sexuality and also the impending potential danger of its expression. So that was done in, like, 1992, so it wasn't so far after. I tested positive in 87, when I was 27.
Let me interject real quick here, Rob. This is something that Eric wrote for a publication in 2012, and I think it really is applicable here, and I'm going to quote Eric. "Creating artwork has been a means for me to express my internal world and to put into form alternative realities rising into consciousness. Through the course of the last 25 years, after testing positive at age 27, HIV and AIDS has informed my interior and exterior worlds in ways that are personal and challenging to put into words. While this experience has been one of extreme trauma, grief, and loss, it has also been a portal to a deeper level of human and spiritual awareness. During the initial years of my diagnosis, while little or no traditional medical treatments were available, My natural response was to delve deeply into metaphysical teachings and alternative therapies, seeking ways to enrich the health of my body, mind, spirit. Engaging with yoga and various groups who congregated in the quest of healing were a way of life. You know, I think it's really interesting that, you know, as you read the words as Eric wrote them, and then you just listen to his description of a piece he created, it really becomes one of those things where you understand that from Eric's perspective, an expanded concept of healing isn't one that's conditional on healing the physical body so much as is an inclusion of healing of the spirit. Would you say that's pretty accurate, Eric?
Yes. There's something that was said earlier by Robert that you know, as I was engaged, like very, very much absorbed in the groups that we spoke of, like the Healing Circle and later Manhattan Center for Living that Marian Williamson started, and then from there went into a group called Friends Indeed, which was founded by a woman named Cynthia O'Neill and along with Mike Nichols. You know, along with the work that we were very much embroiled in, and also my friends who were in ACT UP, and there was some crossover as well, and people were engaged in everything from, you know, things that were coming out medically, which originally was very few, to very esoteric things like, well, you name it, basically. And, you know, it's very tempting to be attached to longevity and healing meaning physical, but as people started to die who were engaged in all the ranges of what they were exploring, you know, I feel really, really fortunate that I translated healing to not have a goal of it being survival, which was challenging, you know, for many people and myself included. And I'm not, you know, I can't cite my survival as any kind of level of success. It's a matter of, and I'm honestly still experiencing a lot of trauma through you know, ongoing concerns of my friends and also myself. But I'm hoping to, you know, well, you know, I hope to lead an intentional life if I can to make use of it.
Okay, Rob?
Yeah, Eric, how has, because I totally relate to everything you're saying. I mean, that was exactly my experience. How has the balance of those early days with that explosion of spirituality, you know, as a, you know, and at the time we thought this could be it. I mean, we at least where when I was attending, there was great hope that, you know, that a spiritual cure would actually sort of come out of this. And then it evolved in the consciousness that the spiritual experience was kind of the point and not, you know, a tool for some other effect. But how did your art reflect over the years the changes of HIV, the threat when it was essentially incurable in the beginning, to hopeful treatments, to a point when the protease inhibitors were introduced and people actually reclaimed life? Was that evident in your artwork as well?
Well, I actually feel in my experience that those of us who held a space for spiritual healing to occur did contribute to the eventuality of the protease inhibitors coming out. Certainly I feel indebted to my brothers that, you know, who were really on the front lines demanding advancements in meditation, because I mean, particularly in my Lee's piece, you know, which are honored people that I knew. There, one in particular, Spencer Cox. You know, a lot of some of his work is a credit of using and developing studies relating to his own body is attributed to the acceleration of the protease inhibitors being released. And yet I also, in my experience, feel that those of us who held a consciousness and were developing a spiritual life within that also created space for what to happen. And it seems within the dialogue that I'm experiencing, because I'm quite involved with this organization, Visual Aids, who does HIV awareness through the visual arts, and also the Leslie Lohman Museum of Gay and Lesbian Art here in New York is a really vital organization, contributing a voice within to the gay community, evolving gay community with art, but also this community of people that are around it, that there's more and more of a consciousness and dialogue that all of these things contributed to where we are and are continuing to, what's continuing to evolve. And initially, it seemed understandably that people wanted to divide into camps of who did what and what had better achievement, and you know, people were, you know, dishing, you know, some advocates who were, you know, more political were dismissive of the quilt participating, and how can the thing of beauty describe what we're going through. But over time, I feel like people are thankfully seeing that there's a broader relationship and interweb of what has actually contributed to what we've been through, also where we're going. For myself, I have bodies of work that have really yet quite to be seen. One is a group of photographs, which are largely self-portraits with the inclusion of portraits of men that I was close to, and they're mostly nude, so it traces a subtle shift and change in my body, and look at my own sexual identity, and in the sense, at times a sort of quiet celebration and reflection of that. And one of the central photographs of it is this two-circle Lazarus, because it was taken in 1998, or 1999 actually, 1998, on the farm of this man, Ramsey McPhillips, in Oregon. And on that farm, his partner, his late partner, Mark Morris, where his ashes were scattered. So I took this self-portrait with the help of Ramsey on the farm that Mark's ashes were buried at a time when I was coming through this rebirth. And it's a very virile-looking photograph. I have an erection, and I have really long hair, but I'm enveloped by these branches, and I'm holding one, so it looks quite like I'm actually part of the woods. And so seeing that photograph in the context of these other earlier ones, where I'm like in Edward Albee's artist residency, where I was in 94, you can see, you know, my body through a screen door, and it slides. And then at the McDowell Colony, where I went, where I had a residency shortly after my transformation to this vital state, there's a photograph of me in this broken mirror, and it's quite sexualized, and I'm holding my nipples, and I have an erection, and it's called Portal. So throughout my experience, or throughout my artwork, you can sort of see within it this dialogue of this young man who tested positive when he was 27 into actually where I am today, more today. And the body of work as a whole, whether it be sculpture or photography or drawing or these wire renderings of my friends in the form of leaves, it seems like a memoir to the whole experience that I've been through.
It sounds like weaved in your work is a strong correlation between sexuality and spirituality. How do you see those two coming together? Pardon the expression.
Well, I think they're very much part of the same thing, and art and creating energetically. There are times when I'm creating my work, which I know is not unusual for an artist, that I can get kind of turned on because it's an energetic experience that's coming through me. So I see sexuality and creativity and even what one might think of as mental challenges being kind of intertwined. I don't know, actually. I think some of that was innately within me, but then if we're going to go back to my Uncle Elijah's world and him being very much involved with yoga, and he always carried a volume of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass with him and could quote from him. Actually, I don't think my mother will mind, because Brody likes this story that my mother tells of my mother Shelby and my Uncle Elias having smoked some pot. I guess my Uncle Elias provided it when he was visiting us in where we lived in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. And they were walking along the guardrail along the highway and quoting passages of Leaves of Grass.
The image of your mom and your Uncle Elijah walking on that guardrail, quoting Walt Whitman in Stone to the Gills, just slays me every time I think about it. I just love that.
Well, and of course, that's a story that I wasn't told until maybe even until she told you, or heard her tell you. But I've heard, you know, my uncle and Jack were very much a part of our lives, you know, growing up and until he was killed. And so along with my own experience of him, you know, I continually hear things from my mother and reminded by this one phrase that he said, Shelby, you have to learn how to bend like the willow. And I was honored by Visual Aids, this organization I spoke of with that Vanguard Award. They honor artists once a year that they feel have contributed to the dialogue long run of HIV with their work. But the reason I'm bringing it up now is I was pleased that the woman who introduced me, Barbara Hunt, used that phrase that in which she spoke of my Uncle Elijah and our connection, that he said you had to bend like the willow. And she also had the editorial editor speak from the first issue of Gay with her, where my uncle and Jack co-wrote this document, you know, really expanding on their beliefs and about how the liberation of gay people would be a pathway to liberating, you know, humanity.
And kind of along those lines.
Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, kind of going along those lines, you spoke about how you felt that spirituality that came about, that came out as a reaction to the huge health crisis of AIDS, actually inspired and probably created in the science community the actual advent of the curing medications. Do you look at that further beyond just that environment of the AIDS HIV experience to the whole of the LGBTQ experience, where here we have a society that, you know, as of 40, 50 years ago, you know, the people in it, like your uncle and his partner, were pariahs, and today it has turned around in perspective in a quicker way than almost any civil rights movement in history. Do you see that spirituality core and that horrific thing with AIDS being somewhat responsible for that?
I do. I think it's much more complex than that in terms of where we are today. In some ways, I mean, I do very much not feel, but I have experienced how the visibility of gay people in particular through the AIDS crisis put a face and a human touch to people that, you know, think of them being homosexual, which I actually feel is a much more limited concept than it needs to be. But I see, you know, correlation between, you know, gay marriage and visibility through the AIDS crisis, both to its more positive aspects and also to some more, unfortunate concerns about what gay marriage conceptually can mean. I have a lot of transgender and more sexually fluid friends, whose visibility, you know, is much more, particularly in like places like New York City, but other places as well, you know, it's much more visible and inclusive, though there's certainly a lot to be done. There's my hope is that things will continually evolve and open up, and, you know, I again, unfortunately, you know, I'm in a lot of arts activist communities, which you know, innately have a lot of, you know, broad thinkers, and I have friends, some of my best friends are in their 20s. And who are writers, even curators. And there's one thing that happened a couple of years ago. I donated some artwork to an organization called the Sylvia Rivera Law Project that gives legal counseling to transgender people. And there were I donated a piece of artwork as well as, you know, about 100 other artists from different ages and different, you know, levels of recognition. So it's a very all-inclusive group of people, predominantly these young, expansive individuals. And I was talking to my friend Brian, who's also Brian Healy, who's also a long-term survivor, and you commented on this really expansive, you know, group of lovely individuals. And he said, well, he'd been studying Buddhism, and according to Buddhist thought, these would be the age of those of our friends who had died in terms of reincarnation. And the hair stood on my arms as it is actually now, you know, as if, which is for me this sign that I'm speaking and hearing something that's true.
Let me ask you just real quick. Let's go back to 1987 and the first national march in Washington. Jack was there. I had actually attended myself. I had a conversation with Dr. Frank Kamny. Frank was, of course, there. And Cleve Jones, who, as you know, is the founder of the Maine's Quilt Project. Correct me if I'm mistaken, but you also were at that march, too.
I was.
Okay. Let's talk for a second on a comparative basis. 1987. And I'll be honest with you, on a personal level, I was not out at that point. I couldn't be, particularly in my profession. And then you have people like Jack, who was extremely, you know, out front and been there since the very beginning, open. Frank, of course, himself, Kay, Barbara, Dr. Lilia Vinchez, and these, of course, all people that you know. But compare that time, 1987, and fast forward it, you know, the 30 years we are now here later. What do you think, Eric, is probably the most important change that you've seen as we start to look at a new national march being called for this month, obviously as a direct reaction to the current president of the United States? But compare the two for me for a second, because you have been one of those people that have been fortunate enough to sit on the sidelines of the game of history and witness it. So give me some feedback and some feedback on it, if you don't mind.
On the time of that march and today in galvanizing towards another one?
Yeah, going from that march in 1987 to one now, and what's the most significant thing that has changed, do you think, overall? Rob had asked you about the pandemic and the significance, which I agree. I think that was it was a game changer for the LGBTQI movement. But I think there's more to that, and I was just wondering if I could get your impression, if you don't mind.
I think that going back to how we opened the program, I think it's certainly a natural temptation to feel sunken how much further have we gone in terms of really global concerns, and particularly how our country is going. So it presents a challenge to not just feel like you've been punched, and so I don't know if you help me a little bit, one thing that I have experienced in my own community, which is actually quite vast and overlaps, is that there seems acknowledgement that the marches and experiences of starting in that early time period, even going forward, that those men and women, whether they're straight or gay or whatever ethnicity they are, but they're, in my experience, they're coming together and utilizing certain tools that were had in a desire to, and kind of automatic inclusivity. And the visibility and inclusivity of these things, there is a gay rally right after the Women's March here in New York. But I think that it was, if I'm not wrong, I think that it was presented in support of open borders that was being done in terms of what's been happening with particularly around Muslims entering the United States. So right in that particular spot, which was right across, right by the Stonewall Inn, where the Stonewall riots happened, there was this inclusivity that we're not a separate cause, which in itself was just really very beautiful.
Okay. You just mentioned the Stonewall Inn. Jack and Lige, of course, were on Fire Island the first few hours of what later became known as the Stonewall Riots or Rebelling, depending upon who you talk to. And then, of course, they appeared and they spent the next few days both collecting stories in front of the Stonewall Inn and, of course, within the gay community. As you walk by that location today, what's your sense? I mean, and you said this to me before, and I think it's probably extremely credible, that your Uncle Lige oftentimes walks with you. And how do you think that he would look, given how he was, where we're at today? And as you walk by that building, do you think about that? The a lot of the things that Lige himself really believed in and really embraced is happening through the expression. I mean, you get a sense of satisfaction from that, a sense of wonderment and excitement, and does it even at times translate into what you do as an artist?
Well, one thing that which we actually really haven't touched on is that within this is still like a rewarding yet rather complicated moment in time, and also, I think a hopeful one. But I think in another conversation you said there's a learning curve, and we're at a time with sexuality and sexual expression that there's a whole range of things and tools that are now accepted as being safer sex tools that aren't just condoms, and mm-hmm. and that affects not only youth, but it also affects older people who have been traumatized by the AIDS crisis, you know, loss and also fear, and there's potential within the range of what is possible now for there to be healing within the community, which could use more dialogue and open forums, and there are. And there's the ramifications of what AIDS has done to how we communicate with one another, both more openly and expansively, but also in a more limited way, has still some evolving to do. So you're going by the if I were going by the Stonewall Inn, there's a whole range of experiences and thoughts and emotions that could come through.
Okay, fair enough, Rob.
Yeah. Eric, we are down to our last literally 3 minutes. What haven't we asked that people need to know about your work?
Does that make sense to you too? Or no?
Actually, it does. It makes perfect sense to me.
Right. So in relationship to my work, I look at my work and my experience very much at this point of time as being multifaceted, which includes my archival material and my stories as well as my Elijah's, because the twin Steve Yates, the legend that's twin Steve Yates has been giving, sending me photographs and material. So I'm feeling like I'm both the caretaker of his archives and legacies that haven't been placed in universities as well as my own. And then also these younger men and women that are my friends who are part of the conversation, that there's an acknowledgement that the ephemera within my work and life and those of my friends are actually part of our art making process too. There's a beautiful exhibition now that I'm included in at the Museum of the City of New York called Art and AIDS. It's called AIDS at Home, Art and Everyday Activism, that a young man, Stephen Vider, curated as part of his fellowship at the museum. And it has a whole range of experiences of how HIV and AIDS affected home life. And within that room, it shows both ephemera and objects of art. I have a photograph called Band-Aid of my torso with a Band-Aid in my chest, as well as a more abstract piece called Notes on Blood Work, and then another one about a sperm cell with little bits of jewelry making around it. And
beautiful.
In relationship to these other photographs. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So
I have to wind this up. We're about to be cut off here. Thank you both for joining us tonight. And Eric, your work is outstanding. And I want to thank you both for being on the show. And Eric, your work is currently being exhibited there?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's going to be up with amongst actually a lot of my friends, both who are alive and friends of mine who died, through, I think, October 22nd.
So if you're in New York, check out the exhibit and check out Eric's work online. Brody's work is on the new civil rights movement currently, his articles and astute observations of the current political climate. I'm Rob Watson, and you can hear me Saturday night on Out in Santa Cruz, where we cover the topic of We Are Indivisible. And if you're in Santa Cruz, I will be at the center stage of Pride, doing Out in Santa Cruz live on stage. And again, we will be doing We Are Indivisible, and we will be celebrating LGBT movement and everything else. But also listen to this program. Come back next week. We'll have a new program for you, a new show, and keep the conversation going. Thanks for joining us tonight. And thank you, gentlemen, for being my guests. Very much appreciated.
Thanks
very, very inspirational.
Well, thank you.